NASA, by the way, is planning to put a space shuttle in orbit in autumn of 2004, even though it has made little progress in developing an in-flight capability to repair the kind of damage that doomed Columbia. Liftoff for the shuttle Atlantis tentatively set for September 12th, but opportunities for launch extended to October, NASA says this. Beyond that, opportunities diminish as the agency has restricted itself to daylight launches for at least the first two flights. Because of the three remaining shuttles that will fly only to the International Space Station, there is a 5-minute launch opportunity a day when the station is in orbit that carries it over the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Glenn Steckling has assumed the responsibilities of his family work in the field of UFO and ET research since his father, the late Mr. Fred Steckling, passed away in 1991. This knowledge represents years of personal experiences and collective data. Now armed with firsthand sightings, Glenn continues to present the materials discovered and given his family spanning over 60 years. Mr. Steckling's latest revision to his father's book, fine book, Alien Bases on the Moon, now called Alien Bases on the Moon 2, contains a combination of more than 100 NASA photographs challenging the continued myth behind the dead moon and inhospitable planet theories, and exposes the increasing possibility of extraterrestrial activity there. On the Coast to Coast AM website, Glenn has sent to Lex some photos. Take a look at that while we conduct the interview with Glenn Steckling. Hi, Glenn. Welcome to Coast to Coast. How are you?
Good evening, George. Pleasure to be with you this evening.
Likewise. I'm so glad that you have picked up the work of your father, and you know what? I think you were destined to do that from the get-go, weren't you?
Well, I believe that's probably true since I've been exposed to it probably from the age of four, so it's definitely part of my life's experiences.
Tell us a little about him, your father.
My father was very interested in aviation since my grandfather was a pilot in the Second War, and my father gravitated towards aviation as well. And during those years after the war, he collected a large map with a number of articles and reports of unidentified flying objects over Europe and pinned them into the global map. And then later when he immigrated to this country, he continued to pursue those interests. And I believe that most of that culminated in March of 1963. When the family was together in downtown Washington, D.C., coming out of the department store along with about 30 other people on the street side, along with a reporter from the Washington Daily News, we noticed a bell-shaped silvery object hanging over the city, low altitude, about 1,500 feet. And this was later reported in the Washington Daily News, which I still have the original article in our archives. And due to this sighting of this craft, which he had seen duplicated many other reports throughout Europe through the 40s and 50s, he went to the Library of Congress and started his research and found books that had pictures, clear pictures, close-up pictures of this very same type of craft we noticed over Washington, D.C. in 1963. And that progressed from there.
Was it a mission for him, an obsession for him, Glenn, to try to get to the bottom of all this?
No, I wouldn't say it was an obsession. What he was is he was an intensely curious person. And once he was a type of pragmatic person that, you know, if he could feel it, touch it, then it was real for him. And until that time, he had to satisfy his own curiosity. So I would say it was closer to a hobby, one that, of course, carried into further and further things as this whole program involved for him.
From that 63 sighting, what led him up to the moment where he wrote the book Alien Bases on the Moon?
Well, in 63, going to the Library of Congress, he went to the alphabetical section and came across an author by the name of George Damski.
Oh, yes.
Under the A section.
Mm-hmm.
And in the books, Flying Saucers Have Landed, which was co-authored by Desmond Leslie, the great-nephew to Winston Churchill, there were some of these pictures in there. So he found out that Mr. Adamski was on the West Coast, and he contacted him. And George Adamski was coming to the East Coast to lecture to the Air Force Reserves in 1963. So we made an agreement to meet the man when he came out to the East Coast, and a very close friendship endured after that point. And we actually spent the majority of our time either with him in our house or in the house of the Rotifers, which he stood out in Silver Springs with, every time he came out to Washington, D.C., And along with Mrs. Rodifer, my father and mother helped arrange some of the international press conferences and other events that Mr. Adamski went to.
So they really got involved.
Very involved. Absolutely. And we also had the opportunity to witness some of these crafts flying low level, which were later photographed in the Silver Springs February of 1965 film. When Mr. Adamski passed away in April of 1965, he was buried in Arlington Cemetery. And he gave my father possession of a lot of the material and told him to go on and continue the work. And in 1967, my father contacted NASA at Goddard Space Flight Center,
mm-hmm.
went there before 22 scientists, showed the films, the pictures, had a very intense discussion about this entire subject.
So they gave him an audience.
Oh, absolutely. Gave him an invitation. And also, within a month from that time, Colonel Freeman out at the Pentagon issued the same thing. So they went right from NASA to the Pentagon, both within, 6 weeks' time. And to say the least, that this was not reticuled information. In fact, they knew a great deal about it. They knew what the ships looked like. They were aware of the probability of their propulsion systems and what have you. So this was not a session where, they tried to debunk the entire situation. It was very much the opposite. Then, due to the contacts he developed and over there at NASA, later on in the 70s, when he started to collect more information from the spaceflight program, Lunar Orbiter's Apollo program,
right.
They directed him to a particular division where he could order the microfiche. They come in catalogs of 2x2 pictures, or you can get the microfiche itself.
So NASA was helpful to your father. As a matter of fact, I noticed that he was very thankful to NASA for helping provide him some material in his book.
Absolutely. I wouldn't say NASA as the organization, because these were individuals that were incorporated within NASA's program.
Okay.
But he was very thankful and very understanding of why some of this information is kept, so to speak, quiet, why some of it is released gradually, and so on and so forth. So he did not ridicule them. He was more interested in obtaining the information to make it available to the public.
Mm-hmm.
He figured since they were underfunded and understaffed, if he could help out, then everybody would be a winner.
So he continues to do his research.
Right.
And then, now, at this point, Glenn, had he decided to write a book, or was he just trying to collect data?
Well, it was he was working towards the publication of a manuscript. That's correct.
Okay.
And that culminated in the first book, Alien Bases on the Moon. And from there, after he passed away, then I added some revisions to it in order to, perhaps clarify some of the pictures, because you're looking at magnifications, and sometimes you have lunar orbiter shots, so the film isn't quite as clear as a Hasselblad picture from Apollo and whatnot.
Mm.
So I was basically asked by a great deal of people around the world to see if I could not enhance it a little bit, and then I tried to put my two cents worth.
Now, the first printing of the book was 1981, right?
That's correct.
That's when it first came out. What was the response when it first came out, if you recall?
Great response. In 1984, he was invited to a select committee before the British House of Lords, where he presented the material as well. He was invited on national television in Japan. He went and lectured to universities in Australia. He did several European lecture tours, but he had already been doing, he had been involved from the film doing lecture tours since 1964. So in Europe, he was pretty well known at that point already. So the response to the book and the information was very positive and continues to be very positive.
You have updated the book, and of course we'll get into what it is and your thoughts and your dad's thoughts about the alien bases. You have updated the book. Why? What happened?
Well, I thought that it would be valuable to the reader to have a little bit of a background information on how my father got involved in this particular field, so to kind of round out the picture a little bit. And also, towards the end of it, to add a little bit of a generalized idea to give people about how science is progressing towards that the evolution of life and the composition of life continues to exist throughout the cosmos, and so it should not be a great you know, surprised to find out that we're not alone in the universe. And I don't think, you know, the last Gallup poll, more than 50% of the people definitely believe that we are not alone in the universe.
Was your father a believer prior to getting involved with Adamski, even beyond that sighting?
Yes, because he had seen, they had had sightings prior to that in different locations. And so that was one of the first sightings in 63 in Washington that led him to go to the Library of Congress. But they had, he had tracked these things for probably 10 years beforehand. So he always felt that, you know, looking up into the stars, that, you know, we're not the only inhabited place here in this little planet of ours.
What were some of the things that that Adamski taught him? Because your father was an integral part of the Adamski Foundation, was he not?
Yes, he became eventually, he was co-director and then eventually director.
All right, tell us a little bit about that foundation. I mean, what were some of the things that Adamski believed?
Well, Adamski had taken already since 1947 some very clear telescopic pictures and later movie films of these crafts in action. And he made these pictures available to the government upon request. He was not a person to hoard information. He was very free and open with that. And I believe to some extent he became a pioneer in this particular field because he was not afraid to go out on the road and talk about this subject. And we know, you know, already Roswell happened in 47, and things continue to accelerate in 52, the sightings over Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a large plethora of activity to support Mr. Adamski as he went out and he talked, and there were sightings in many of the countries where he went as well. And so George was able to provide the foundation to my father to give him the ability to recognize these crafts more readily, to be in specific places and specific times, sometimes with him and sometimes without, so to carry that one step further. So he was, in a way, sort of a mentor, I would say.
So, and you grew up right in the middle of all this.
I grew up right in the middle of it, that's correct.
As we jump ahead now, your father putting together the book Alien Bases on the Moon, do you remember the excitement that I'm sure he had to have had, Glenn, when he started looking at some of these photographs?
Well, absolutely. I was there with him when the catalogs arrived and the microfiche, and then consequently you order the pictures themselves to come, oh, let's say in, you know, 15 by 20, some of the larger formats.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through and he collected and ordered and paid for hundreds of these photographs to do the research, and we looked at the with magnifying glasses, upside, downside, backwards, and forwards. And the more we looked at these pictures, the more we found that the dead moon theories that we have been telling people for so long and supporting for so long, there seems to be quite a contrary information to that. And this is also some of the information that Adamski talked about already in 1953. He described the firefly effect that Glenn talked about. Adamski described that in 55, and he talked about greater atmospheric conditions on the moon and the fact that there are reports of clouds and what have you. So he was looking for that tangible proof in our own space program that led him back to his earlier association with George.
Well, I've got to tell you, looking at the pictures, either they were altered when they were given to you and your father years ago, or they're pretty darn reliable, because some of them you look at and you go, oh my God, what's
there?
Well,
the interesting thing is that we've had, when the book came out, my father gave full disclosure and credit, and you'll notice in the book that all the serial numbers for the pictures were included, and he encouraged the public, say, hey, write to them, order the pictures, do the research, and you'll see for yourself. And so he encouraged the public to get actively involved, and some people did. There are some gentlemen in Germany and some in other countries that right thereafter ordered pictures and got the same kind of pictures. 10 years later, some people have ordered the same serial numbers and they find some alterations. So one can take that one way or the other.
Glenn, did your father believe that there were alien bases on the moon prior to our landings, or did that come afterwards?
Oh, he believed it prior, because we have had reports from astronomical societies. They're talking here, very interesting little report that comes out from the England's Royal Astronomical Society between the years of 1869 and 1871, where they collectively reported sightings of objects moving, 50-mile opaque objects, great white domes, long bridge-like structures, and so on and so forth. So there's enough credible information from astronomical observations prior to our space program that have led more than a number of people to suggest that there is activity on the moon.
And you, of course, believe we have went to the moon, right?
Well, of course, absolutely. I believe that argument, I've heard the opposite side of that argument as well. And when you look at the pictures that have come back, obviously, first of all, we know we've gone under orbit around the Earth, and we know that we went with the lunar module and with the support craft to the moon and orbited, because we have taken such clear shots of Earthrise coming over the lunar surface. And also during the Apollo 11 and 12 programs with ground-based telescopes, you were able to focus on the Sea of Tranquility, and with enough magnification, you could see the LEM taking off and so on and so forth, and see the orbiter as well. So, you know, you have photographic evidence from both sides of the...
Well, and I share your thoughts. I believe we went to.
And I think that we do also our astronauts a great disservice, because these were gentlemen who faced, and ladies and gentlemen now, that face immense odds, and at that time technology that was, let's face it, your laptop today has twice the computing power than all of the Apollo computers
true.
Put together at
that's
that time.
True.
So, you know, these people risked life and limb, and they did an incredible service.
Not quite a Model T going to the moon, but pretty darn close, wasn't
very
it?
Very close, if you think about it in comparison. You know, we still have a very fledgling space program that unfortunately lags many years behind our other technologies that could be put to good use.
How long, Glenn, and this is all speculation here on your part, but how long do you think these alien bases might have been on the moon?
Well, that is an open-ended question. I think that there have been a number of anthropologists and archaeologists have suggested that ancient civilizations have left some type of record of interactions with what we would call extraterrestrials. So, for all intents...
At least on this planet you're talking
that's
about.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and we're talking about people like Ari Bogdanikin, and there's many programs that were produced that question some of the advancements and some of the hieroglyphs and petroglyphs portraying, like for that one down in the Mayan area of a person sitting in a capsule with fire coming out of the bottom, and so on and so forth. And so, literally, we could say that ancient records as far back as China, 4,000 years ago, have left reports of such sightings or interactions. So it's possible that the moon has been used as an observation platform for at least as long as that.
All right, stay with us, Glenn. Glenn Steckling, I guess we're going to really get into these alien bases and get his thoughts on exactly what might be there. What might be there. And again, he believes that we are still going to the moon. We'll find out a little bit more about that, too. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com.
Right, right, you're bloody well right. You got a bloody right to say. Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. Ha ha, you're bloody well right. You know you're right to say.
And yes, those of you fast blasting me later on in the program, we will open up the website and allow you to look at more pictures, and more importantly as well, phone numbers will be given and you can chat with Glenn all you want. We're talking about his book, Alien Bases on the Moon, and also his father's book. He did the revision, called it Alien Bases on the Moon 2. Let's talk about some of these purported alien bases, if we can, Glenn, for a moment. Some of the pictures, I will admit, look very strange indeed. They're just objects there that make you want to look two, three, four times to figure out exactly what's going on there. There's a series that you have in the book. Mm-hmm. It looks like some kind of a tractor device that is leaving a miles and miles of a very strange print that you would see from a tire, for example.
Yeah, there's also, if you look slightly north to that picture, there's also a very faint track of a much smaller device as well that's leading out of in front of it by about 15 degrees.
Let's talk about some of the bases. What do you think is out there?
Well, I believe through observation and collection of data and networking, I believe that the moon is being used as an observation platform, and also from the photos, that it seems that there is some type of activity going there. The one picture that I provided for your website there of that small crater, where it looks you can see the material dumping out of the crater into the larger one as it obscures the crater lip. And other pictures that are in the book showing terracing of craters and things like that seems to show that some type of perhaps mining activity is going on the moon. And of course, there's a great deal of talk and speculation how much of it may be extraterrestrial and how much of it may be terrestrial based.
Like we probably kept going back there?
Well, there is some speculation to say that we have the technology and the capabilities of going back there, and there are other countries that have talked and devoted sections of their, you know, gross national product to set up facilities on the moon and to explore the mining potential. So it's not a far-fetched concept. It actually, that in the asteroid belt would provide a great deal of raw essential material, and perhaps we could give our own planet a little bit of a break here.
If we're going back, why are we keeping it a secret when we kept the first groupings of Apollo missions so public?
Well, that particular program, of course, was at the inspiration of President Kennedy when he challenged us to put forward a progressive space program, and that it would unite and not only people in their thinking and education and technology, but unite economies mm-hmm. as well, to give an opposite direction towards the same old status quo, so to speak. And so that program and those programs were, of course, very visible because the administration's honor, so to speak, rested upon the continuance. Those were the good things, and obviously, as the Vietnam War escalated, we needed good news for a change, and so those programs continued to be very much in the forefront. Then, of course, after Apollo 17 in the mid-1970s, there were so many budget cuts. There was a great amount of questioning of why we would spend money to go into space when obviously we needed a great deal of funds to fix problems here on this planet. And so basically, for lack of anything better, public support simply evaporated. And then it was very easy to cut these programs and then completely throw it off.
You think they're black ops trips?
I would not be surprised if they're black op trips. Because, you know, naturally we are experimenting. Nothing ever stands still. When we look at the development of our research and development of Skunk's Works and things like that, the public generally gets sight of these things, you know, one decade or sometimes two decades after the development itself.
Sure.
And nothing ever stands still. We never completely kill any program. We never, you know, completely whitewash it. There's always something going on behind the scenes. And I would not for a minute doubt that the benefits of going to the moon were very obvious, and that that we have continued to go there.
How would they launch without the public seeing the launch? They can't do it from Kennedy.
There's different ways to look at that. Of course, there are other launch facilities that are available, one in the Indian Ocean. And so, you know, you launch from that particular facility and you can be in equatorial orbit, you know, way the long time before you get to the West Coast. Or, of course, there have been others who have suggested that we have progressed past the fiery vehicle, strap yourself to a missile technology, and develop technology that does not require to sit on the back of a Saturn V.
What kind of materials, if indeed it is us, what kind of materials do you think they're mining from the moon?
Well, there's a number of benefits there from the moon. Working in that particular environment, of course, is very arduous, but the access to raw material, one report once came out and said that the type of materials that we now mine off of our planet, as far as things like titanium, gold, diamonds, industrial-type composites that we use, and so on and so forth, is much more readily available and much more abundant on that satellite body.
Well, but aren't diamonds created from carbon? I don't think there's carbon on the moon.
Well, that's a debatable point. I mean, obviously, a satellite body is developed from the same materials the planet is developed from, in one stage or another. So would it be so outrageous to expect that over a period of time minerals develop and other perhaps alterations of certain things that could be beneficial is also available as well? And after all, diamond, for all intents and purposes, is a very common stone. If it would not be held back by the diamond consortiums, you could buy it for a dollar a carat. So it's more of intrinsic value than it really is a substance.
If this program is ongoing, and we say that it's black ops, might it also be done without the knowledge of NASA, official knowledge of NASA? Because here we are struggling with a space shuttle program,
mm-hmm.
and in areas like that, and if indeed there's black ops with better technology, I got to believe NASA doesn't know anything about it.
I would certainly agree with that conclusion. Just because one agency is specifically specialized in one particular thing, you have to remember that it is a consortium of military officers that have a certain amount of input from the Pentagon and what have you. So there are many different input leads into NASA. And naturally, if information doesn't want to be given, then people go about their daily jobs. You have very dedicated engineers who are trying to work on the space shuttle program on a device that's 25 years old. And you have dedicated people who are working at all the data that comes in from all the various programs that these people have said, we have no way, we don't have the staff or personnel to analyze it. It goes into rooms and closed cold environment file cabinets, and there it sits. Nobody takes a look at it. So these people are hired to do a job, and it doesn't mean that they have access to other things that are going on, and that's quite clear.
Might we be dealing with several things here, Glenn, and that could be the possibility of an ongoing moon visitation program here,
mm-hmm.
and also, though, alien bases that have been there for, as you say, eons, and maybe there's something else going on the moon as well that they're going there for beyond just looking for minerals in other materials. Maybe if there are, as you believe, in alien bases there, maybe there's some working relationship there?
Interaction? That would come to a common conclusion. I mean, you go somewhere and somebody else is there, you usually go by and say, hello, we're in the neighborhood.
Or you're there with their blessing.
Well, I don't believe that it's necessarily an ownership issue. Remember, the Treaty of 1967 demilitarizes space and the moon to no particular country's empowerment. Whether they're still honoring that treaty, well, that's a different story. But if we go there, I don't see any reason why we would not be welcomed. And if we went there aggressively, then certainly our technology is way under there. So that would be a rather foolish course of action.
Before we get into what you believe our astronauts saw when they first went to the moon, let's see if we rule this in or out. What about the possibilities that these bases were put there by us, but by past civilizations, civilizations that might have existed on this planet thousands and thousands, if not millions of years ago?
Well, that's an interesting question. It would be a theory to look into, but it would be, since the data would be so old or records very difficult to decipher, that would be up to the individual to dedicate their time to that particular avenue.
In your opinion, then, these structures on the moon, these bases on the moon that you believe are there, were put there by whom?
Initially, I believe they were put there by extraterrestrial visitors. And then I believe over a period of time, we've had an opportunity to pool our scientific capabilities and also visit the moon as well in a more permanent nature.
When the Apollo astronauts went to the moon, starting in 1969, what do you think they started to see when they were on the moon?
Well, of course, that would be up for the Apollo astronauts to divulge. However, there have been reports that some of these astronauts, there is a very interesting book put out by Maurice Chatelain, who holds the patents for the Apollo communication system. And in his book, Our Ancestors Came from Outer Space, he conclusively says that every single spaceflight mission, both in orbit and to the moon and back, was accompanied or came into the presence of extraterrestrial spacecraft. So he feels that that our people were never unaccompanied or, to say, abandoned in space should something go wrong.
Do you think they, and this is all speculation on your part here, but do you think our astronauts expected to be accompanied like that?
I don't believe so. No, I believe we operate on a need-to-know basis, and of course, when you are involved in these particular programs or you're a commissioned officer and what have you, there are certain documents which will require you to stay silent on the pretense of national security. And of course, I believe to some degree they were unaware. And I believe Gordon Cooper, who in his book Leap of Faith, he puts it very clearly.
Well,
yes, absolutely, and I think some of them were greatly astounded, and I've heard reports of there being transmissions when they took the lunar lander, that little rover, and rode around. There were reports that there were transmissions that the astronauts, when they went to the edge of the crater, said, "Oh my God, look down there! Look what's here already before us," and so on and so forth. And so, they're there to do a job, and they have to operate within the confines of what they are told to do, and I don't think that trying to get them to divulge otherwise, where they will have to suffer the consequences, is very wise on their part.
Do you believe our astronauts were ever threatened?
No. I mean, threatened in what way? By ourselves?
No, by possible aliens?
Okay. No.
So nothing like that. Not get off the moon, don't ever come back, nothing like
that. No, of course not. That would have been our space program, and already from the Gemini and Mercury days, we made our intent very clear to go to the moon. It would have been very easy to prevent us to getting off the launch pad if that was the intent. No, I have not found in my research or interactions over all these years, and I can speak the same for my father, Mr. Adamski, as well, that any interactions that they were aware of or had researched and collected data on had anything to do with any aggressive nature. If anything, they were there to provide assistance should it be required.
If the aliens are on the moon with bases, why? Why not just put them here? What are they doing?
Well, who says they haven't? I mean, it's quite a possibility. I mean, we have a very large unexplored ocean depths. We have areas of the planet that are, let's say these days, not quite so inaccessible as before, but there are plenty of areas You know, if you fly in Central South America, there's still huge non-radar environments in which there are, you know, millions of square miles of open land. And I have talked to a number of people in a lot of these countries who have talked of seeing these luminescent devices come flying down into the canyon. In fact, I had a very good conversation with somebody in Baja California about that. They see if they call the Valley of the Luminescence, and they've seen crafts fly into the valley and disappear into the mountain valleys, but they never come out. So it's possible that there are landing sites or bases here on this world, and I think the moon would be a very logical place initially if you want to set up a shop and take a look and see what we're all about.
We're going to go through next hour with you, Glenn, some of the photos that you provided us that we have up on the website, and get your take on what you think some of those objects may or may not be. Mm-hmm. In all of this, is there anything there that just has shocked you?
Well, shocking me is not quite so easy.
Not anymore.
You know, after all, I've seen these things since the age of four or five.
You're so desensitized.
Well, what I'll say is it's pleasant to see additional confirmation. You know, when you see a luminescent object hanging over the head of the astronaut, you know, that is, you know, quite an interesting photograph, or that cylindrical-shaped object that is on your website there, that Lunar Orbiter 4 HR-1571 picture. It shows the cylindrical device horizontal of the crater, and so on. And these are just, you know, a very soft, small selection I could rapidly scan and get sent to you in comparison to what's in the book, and let alone in what is in the archives. But it's nice to see more and more confirmation of what you knew and experienced to be true already for a long time.
Would you ever want to go to the moon yourself, Glenn?
Absolutely. Oh, I'd volunteer in a heartbeat. You know, if I had $20 million, I'd go with the Russians.
There has been some talk, recent talk, that there are just so many huge structures on the moon.
Yeah.
One, John Lear was talking to Art a couple weeks ago. And,
oh, yeah, I know John very well.
Okay, talked about a structure that may have been made by who knows whom, that is a 7-mile-high tower.
The one with the ball hanging
uh-huh,
on it? The
uh-huh.
other one that looks like a very large Van de Graaff generator.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was... I talked about that with John already years and years ago. But, there have been some astronomers who have focused, or amateur astronomers who have focused their telescopes on specific areas in conjunction with photos from the space program of that particular area, where they can see the shadow cast of a large structure. And some of the photos in my father's book also lead towards structural development on the surface of the moon, and so I think that is quite common.
Would being on the moon be a great place to wait before you launch an invasion of Earth?
Well, first of all, I don't think invasion comes into question. You know, if you can get to the moon, the moon to the Earth is not even, you know, firing up the retro rockets, so to speak. It's just a small piddly jump.
All right, hold that thought, because I want to ask you that again when we come right back. We are quickly at the top of the hour. More to come with Glenn Steckling and phone calls as well. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Subscribe to the After Dark newsletter and reserve your free CD of Art Bell and the late Father Malachi Martin. 888-727-5505.
And welcome back. I'm George Norrie with my guest, Glenn Steckling. Glenn, the book, by the way, let me ask you now, and we'll bring it up again in the last hour. Where can you get it?
Well, it's available from us directly down here in Vista, California. If you wish the book, you simply, it's $19.95, and we send it to you airmail postage, so that's another $3.50 for that. And the address is GAF International, P.O. Box 1722, in Vista, California, 92085. And also you can obtain it through Baker & Taylor, Borders Books, Amazon.com, all of those companies and others also order directly from us.
More than 100 NASA photographs and some area blow-ups there in this book. I mean, it's if you're into pictures and you want to look at things, that's there. And a lot of the pictures have already been blown up for you. Boy, there's one here that has what is supposed to be a crater, and I've never seen a more rounder circle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's incredible.
A whole series of very concentric craters, as if they are carved out by very fine machinery. And sometimes in the inside of the craters you will find symbols. If you look on page 160, you'll find there that there's a lunar orbiter shot with a very clear S raised in the middle of the crater. Also below it on the lunar plane itself. And so there are circumstances of symbols and letters carved in the surface as well.
There's no question that is an S.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, that's not even one of those, well, maybe it's an object that looks like an S. No. This clearly looks like an S.
Oh, yeah.
Something that you would see in Eric von Däniken's book.
Absolutely. And there's another photo here as I'm thumbing through trying to find it, but there's one that shows a very large question mark. It's horizontal, it's vertical, but... Yeah, we probably have a lot of questions.
Well, you know, with the moon being 4.5 billion years old as well, who knows who might have visited that thing?
That's
correct. And left things behind. Or
well, we were on the subject here of using the moon of the platform of invasion.
Yes.
And if we kind of take a clear-eyed step back here, I think some type of historical sense is really in order, because there seems to be a very definitive line between reports and stories and sensationalism that has evolved after the late 1960s and that what happened before. So if we look at a combined archaeological record of, let's say, perhaps back as far as the Chinese, who talked about flying vehicles, cylindrical shape, we're looking at 4,000 years. And these crafts have been visiting us for that long. You know, if they were going to invade us, it would simply have been very easy to do during the horse and buggy or chariot times, since they had the technology then, and
mm-hmm.
we were still running around in loincloth. So I don't think that the invasion scenario, although it might be very sensational to some imaginations, is very valid. And if we look at the original contacts that happened from the late 40s, up till, let's say, 1960, that was not the context of any of them, whether they were landing in Mexico near the pyramids, near Buenos Aires, all over the world, they were photographed, the same type of crafts, in different years, different time, different conditions, so, you know, they cannot talk about fixing photos. That the interactions were always of a positive, a progressive, a purposeful nature. And so, if we excite the mind that someone is coming to get us, they could have gotten us a long time ago. And if really we're worried about aggression and destitute, we really produce enough of that on this planet on our own. I don't think any outside influence would really change the outcome much.
Glenn, any support from other investigators who agree with you, with your father's theories about these bases?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's some other books that were published. There was a book published called Moongate, and I can't remember the author off the top of my head. It's in the archives. And there's another one called Somebody Else is on the Moon. I think that was Bryan's was one of the authors. But they did similar research. Researchers and scientists, we went in 89 to a conference in Europe in which the Soviet, the wall had come down, and there were some former Soviet scientists there that my father talked to quite extensively. And I actually just got a UFO report from the society in Ukraine. They were talking about why the former Soviet military response is much more benign than our own concerning these craft. I would say that there's a great deal of support into this, and I received an enormous amount of contacts when my father passed away from countries and organizations that I didn't even know we were all corresponding with.
We've got plate number 57. Go to that for a second.
Flight 57, you got a page?
Yeah, that is on... It is on 111, 111, it would be.
Okay.
A number that continually
There we are, Lunar Orbiter shot, which is also one of the shots that's on your website.
That's the one with a perfectly round circle.
That's correct.
Now, what is that structure immediately underneath it? Is that a triangle object over it? Is that a pyramid-shaped object? What do you think that is?
First thing to do when you look, when you're doing observations from altitude or looking down on pictures like in this method, is to determine from which direction the sun's coming from. And you can see that if you turn this plate so the number 19 is facing you, that the top of the page or the north of that picture is where the sun's coming from because it illuminates the bottom half of the crater. It also illuminates, if you would put your pencil right next to it, it would illuminate the face of that cylindrical object. And the fact that it's slightly off the ground throws a shadow from the angle of which the sun comes
okay.
from. It's the same thing as if you look at the next lunar orbiter shot that shows the cloud over the lip of the crater. You can see the lip of the crater, then it's obscured, it throws a shadow underneath, and then the crater continues.
Why does it give a shadow like a pyramid, as opposed to,
well, that
would it be straight?
It could be that it's not exactly symmetrical, it could be that it's elevated at an angle, not necessarily totally horizontal. One end could be tipped up or tipped down.
Which we can't see, I
which
guess.
Which we cannot see, and those lunar orbiter shots were, of course, very rudimentary in the beginning.
All right, let's go to some phone calls as well while we chat with you this hour and next hour. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with Glenn Stecklin. Hi there. Hello. Goodbye. Let's go to our...
That was quick.
That's right. Let's go to East of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
I'm going to identify myself as Mr. Jones.
Well, you don't have to, but why?
Well, because we're working on something. We're a scientific group, a think group, and we're working with NASA. And we have theories that with the solar span expanding, we believe that there was life on Mars. There's a lot of scientific proof coming out with the canals and the ice and everything else, and with the solar span expanding and Mars getting away from to where they were being capable of being sustained with the sunlight.
All right, but we're talking about the moon tonight, Mr. Jones. So
yes,
are you saying that?
I'm getting there.
Okay.
Getting
all right.
There.
Go ahead.
Okay. When they decided to leave Mars, the Earth itself was hit by catastrophic meteorite is one of the theories, and made the moon. What they did was, since the Earth wasn't quite capable of handling life at the time, they went underground in the moon because the moon is like a magnetic force of meteorites and asteroids. And we have great evidence of that, of the craters and stuff. That's why we don't suggest putting moon bases on there, and we prefer it to be studied by the space stations and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're theorizing is, once the Earth starts getting out to where it's not going to be capable of handling the sunlight and the atmosphere going, the Venus will be the next planet coming up, and it's just going to be a gradual going. Do you understand what I'm saying? The solar span expands out from the sun.
Well, and also, Glenn, as you know, George Adamski believed that Venus was where there were beings, did he not?
Yeah, when we were talking about the discontinuity of information, concerning the moon, there is also a dichotomy of information concerning the other planets as well. Of course, we talked at one time that Mars was uninhabitable and that Mars was inhospitable, and Venus as well. And at the same token, now over a period of time, we find out that we have polar ice caps. They're talking about underground water, if not more than that. Sometimes scientists are talking about vegetation. I have a report from Dr. Jastrow here, who in 1980, he was working for NASA and Institute of Space Studies, and he says that he believes the space agency has a skeleton in its closet, that the data from Viking spacecraft that landed on Mars receives positive evidence of primitive kind of life on Mars. So that was in 1980, more than 20 years ago. So a little bit leaks out, then it's forgotten. Then we talk about water, we talk about the possibility of vegetation. Every time we look at this equation, it tends to get better and better.
Mm-hmm.
And my same question is about Venus as well. You know, the Russians sent their probes, we sent our probes. We measured 800, they measured 400. Now they're saying it's closer to maybe 125. They tell the people that they show them radar images of sharp mountains with jagged peaks. At the same time, they tell them that the atmosphere is 100 times denser than ours, 400 and some degrees, and the wind is blowing 400 miles an hour. I mean, that would sandblast that thing into a golf ball in no time. You know, and then they tell the people that we're going to take a spacecraft, a probe, and put a parachute on it and drop it through 100 times denser atmosphere with thermal updrafts of 400 degrees and 400 mile an hour winds. One has to wonder, how is all of this possible? So, but getting back to Mr. Jones's
theories.
Well, theories or his feelings or what have you, they're talking about the possibility of life on Mars, which I believe then is also quite possible. We have the great debate upon the face on Mars, the pyramids in Cydonia, and whether or not they vacated their planet to go somewhere else and to live underground. Well, that is certainly the freedom of one's opinion. Underground isn't necessarily a very nice place to live. We're not groundhogs. Studies have shown that we do need exposure to ultraviolet light, sun, and to the elements, and in order to evolve and survive in a halfway reasonable fashion. And when we talk about the moon, they reported, the Surveyor 5 already reported, that the moon's surface contains materials much like Earth. Silicon and oxygen are one of the most abundant minerals. It talks about that the lunar soil that was brought back by Apollo, that the seedlings that were planted in lunar materials actually grew better than our own, in our own soil, considering the pesticides and what else we do. That's not real surprise. So there is a great deal of commonality between the construction and composition of planets, because we do come from the same primordial ooze when the solar system forms approximately 5 billion years ago.
Well, this entire universe is that way.
Well, of course, we're coming from the same womb of creation where all the materials are combined and put together and spun and cooled and heated and everything else. So we share it all. And more importantly, NASA scientists talk about that, how each planet trails behind it, like a comet, but it's not luminescent, a huge matter trail of biomaterials. And that as we go in orbit, this mixes with the other planets who are trailing it behind there, and we're all bombarded by millions of pounds of meteoric dust, microorganisms, molecules, amino acids, all the compositions of life from space every day. What happens to us happens to everybody else, and we pretty much, you know, you throw it all in the same soup, you're going to get a pretty good tasting soup.
You know, Glenn, I don't know why, though, I keep thinking that maybe hundreds of thousands of years ago, we had civilizations on this planet that had the kind of technology, and they went to the moon, maybe they set up bases, and of course, they've abandoned them because something with some kind of horrible catastrophe occurred here. But I keep thinking that, and I don't know why.
Well, I mean, there's a number of authors who have talked about other civilizations, advanced civilizations, and of course they clash with our common archaeologists, because we continue to want to tell the people that right now in the area of the world where we are having a very large conflict, the cradle of civilization. You know, at one point everybody stopped running around throwing pebbles and spears at animals and decided to sit down by the riverside and now farm, you know. So we have some very interesting leaps of faith in that whole equation. And so, you know, there was, you know, Colonel James Churchwood wrote books about the commonality of symbols between South Pacific, the Mayans, the Egyptians, around the whole planet, and that is still quite an open discussion.
East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast, you're on with us. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, good, go ahead.
How you doing, Glenn? Great show.
Yeah, thank you.
I was just wondering if Glenn believed the moon itself was like a spacecraft or a base, like as in Jim Mars' Alien Agenda book?
Sure, good question. Some have thought that the moon is metallic, for example, hollowed out on the inside.
Titanium shell.
What do you think, Glenn?
Well, I don't know on the titanium shell portion of it. You're talking about a pretty large satellite body here. Yeah, if the construction of that would naturally be an enormous feat. There, I've heard more theorizing about the moons of Mars, you know, that orbit slightly out of normal natural concentric design and what have you. And so there's been a bit of talk about that maybe the moon, one of the moons of Mars, is artificial. I don't know if our own moon is. It still has geological activity, and that's one of the keys to this. They are still reporting sightings of volcanoes and water geysers spraying out of the moon. So that would lend me to believe that the moon itself is still geologically active, and that would, of course, mean that the inner construction of the mantle and the core is still active. So I don't know how conducive that would be to, you know, survival inside the planet, the body itself.
Glenn, when we come back, one of the questions I want to ask you about the possibility of clouds over the moon, and that's tough, that's hard for me to imagine, but there are some photos that are very, very strange indeed, so I'll ask you that and a number of other questions. I'm George Norrie, and yes, this is Coast to Coast AM.
After Dark newsletter is $39.95. Subscribe now and get your free CD of Art Bell and Malachi Martin. Call now 1-888-727-5505.
Couple of photographs, Glenn, show what looks like clouds on the moon. How can that be? It doesn't have an atmosphere, for crying out loud.
Well, that is the debatable point. Let me first recite a couple things from what's called the Chronological Listing of Lunar Events. This is a NASA document released in April of 1966 from Goddard Space Flight Center. In here, at least, the chronology of observations of the moon, starting with 1867. It talks about lunar volcanoes, purplish haze illuminating the crater, patches of mist obscuring the mountains, a strong violet light as if covered by fog. Now we get into the 1900s, glowing light in Plato, red objects moving about, curious faint milky-looking illuminating green, once again the talking of mists covering the crater floor. Well, we all know if we have to have mists and cloud formations, we need to have condensation, we need to have water, we need to have an atmosphere to support it. This document, by the way, goes all the way up to, of course, 1966, and this comes directly from them and is available to anyone. So if you look once again, and do some research, you find that the facts themselves of what was reported leads you in the direction of which we're talking about. Now, of course, in order to have some type of atmosphere, you have to have gravitational force, and you have magnetic force. And when we talk about going to the moon, originally based on the Newtonian theories of 1/6 gravity, the neutral point, the area between where the Earth's gravitational influence meets the moon and causes a neutral point, would have been based at about 25,000 miles. But indeed, the truth of the matter is that the Apollos encountered that at 43 to 44,000 miles. Now, this, when we're talking about equations of such sort, this is just not a doubling. This is an exponential advancement. Now, if you look at the 43,000-mile differential, which was also reported in von Braun's book, we're talking about a gravitational force of the moon almost 60% stronger than what we anticipated. So now we have gravity. We talk about water geysers already in 1971 from Apollo 12 and 14 astronauts, moon geysers shooting out for 7 to 14 hours. And he says the cloud spread to cover the area of more of 10 square miles. Now, you know, we talk about all this revelation now about water on the moon and water on Mars. We were already talking about this 30 years ago.
That's true.
All right, so now we're talking about, we have provided the condensation. Now we talk about atmospheric pressure. When we went to the moon, our LEM was pressurized between 6 and 7 psi. And when you open the hatch, you know you have to have equalization of pressure. Just like in an aircraft, if you maintain a pressure differential, you won't get that door open.
You can't.
You're a gorilla.
Push as much as you want. It's not going to open.
As much as you want all day long. So at about 2.5 psi, the hatch opened without any strain. So it shows that it was a greater atmospheric pressure on the moon. Now we talk about the famous throwing the frisbee. Well, if you throw the frisbee, there has to be something to support it. It just doesn't fly on its own. You have to be able to, a medium to support the frisbee, or hitting the golf ball, or when you watch the lunar rover riding along, you can see the plume of dust coming off the back of the tire and drifting nicely to the surface of the moon because it has an atmosphere to support the particles as it drifts down to the surface. So you put together the composite points and you tend to find that there is a little bit of a different situation there than what we report. I wouldn't like to necessarily go there versus Hawaii for summer vacation. But mind you, excuse me, that was on the front side of the moon where it is much more susceptible to the immense gravitational pull of the Earth.
No, well, do you think our scientists know this?
Oh, absolutely.
So why not?
They publish it.
Why not really fully disclose it to us?
I don't think the public is generally interested, to tell you the truth.
Oh, I think that would be a great story if they said the moon had an atmosphere, there's some clouds there. I think that'd be great.
I have talked to pilots. I have talked to scientists. So they have seen the pictures without saying a word. And they open it up and look at the pictures and say, my God, look here. There's clouds along here. And also, I give you a quote from astronaut Borman. He says, while orbiting the moon, it looks like clouds down there. Also, there was another quote that says, it looks like we're going over what appears to be like a clear mountain lake. You know, so we need to look between the lines, and I think that's where we drop the ball. We expect some recognizable person with alphabet soup behind their name to stand up and tell us and give us the truth when we're a little bit too lazy to go look for it ourselves.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to our first-time caller line. Welcome to Coast. You are on the air with Glenn Stecklin. Hi there.
George.
Yes.
Thank you for having Glenn on as a guest.
You are welcome.
Glenn.
Yes.
Hi, this is Ken in Glendale.
Oh, very good. How are you doing?
How are you, sir?
Very good.
It is an honor to speak to you.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be able to represent the material to all those that are interested.
I had a question about George Adamski.
Yes.
Skeptics frequently hold up the book Pioneers of Space mm-hmm. as proof, quote-unquote, that GA was fabricating everything. This is a nearly impossible book to get, and I have only read one other person's review of it mm-hmm. Besides the skeptics, which was Desmond Leslie wrote a letter to Timothy Good, and
yes,
all he said was that the book was shocking. But he in no way said that it discredited George Adamski. So I would really like to get your take on that and sort of to clear this up for the millions of people that are listening right now.
Well, the initial book, Pioneers of Space, was a composition that George put together to see how the public would react to some of these concepts. And you have to remember that George Adamski just didn't wake up one night and become involved in this process. For most people who are unaware, Mr. Adamski conducted a school of philosophy in the 30s, already was on radio programs in Los Angeles in the late 30s and 40s, talking about the existence of universal life and the fact that we're not alone on this planet. So he was immersed already from a very long time prior to his photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And he had always felt that there was a very high probability of life and that it came to visit us and that it interacted positively. And he wrote that book more as a personal work to give amongst his students and to work on to see how the public would react. And, of course, the critics go after George for saying, well, he wrote one fictional book, so therefore everything else was fictional. Well, I have to remind everybody that Arthur C. Clarke wrote fictional, and Isaac Asimov wrote fictional, and Carl Sagan wrote fictional, Dr. Sagan. But that doesn't take or distract away from the work that has done consequently or in different fields thereafter.
So the claims that the skeptics are making that it's that the stories later that came out in Inside the Spaceships and Flying Saucers Have Landed, the claims they're saying that it's almost verbatim, those are simply not true.
Well, I can only tell you that George was there, the people were there. I know individuals that were on the property, one who is a retired aerospace engineer who's still alive, very high classification of secrecy.
Well, no, they're
on the property, but as far as their implication that it was duplicated, no.
Right.
If you read it closely, if you read Pioneers of Space, it talks about specific specific ideas and concept. It doesn't go into detail. It doesn't give specifics as far as propulsion of craft and so on and so forth. So it's very, you could say the Pioneers of Space would be sort of like an outline to his own personal concepts.
Could he have received some of this information, and I don't want to get too esoteric, but could he have received some of his impressions as impressions when he wrote this material as telepathic impressions?
I would say that to assume that George Adamski initiated his own first contact in the desert of 1952 would be a leap of assumption, because he had exposure to this subject for a great many years beforehand, and he simply was more involved in his school of philosophy and in trying to bring certain concepts to students before he got involved in the rest of this.
Do you believe, Glenn, everything that Adamski said?
I can only vouch for what I experienced in his presence. And I can say that in his presence, I have seen these craft come extremely close. I have seen films he took that were absolutely astounding. I have seen the government agents parking at the end of the driveway to see what would fly over or come by. In fact, my father and I used to take them thermos of coffee down to the cul-de-sac and knock on the window and say, hey, you guys must be getting cold down here. I have seen George go and talk before the people. I have seen him interact with the people who came to visit him. And I have not found to this date what he described in space, what he described what happening with this planet, to be false. In fact, if anything, it continues to grow more and more positive.
And he described these beings, these entities, as being human-like, did he not?
Not human-like, human.
Human.
Human, that's correct. Not looking any different than you and I. And in fact, a lot of the agencies that my father talked to were very interested in that fact, and also were very aware that people came amongst us and worked and lived amongst us for a particular part of time, much like a Peace Corps.
Do they still do that?
They still do that, but they go to the areas of the world where they're most responsive to. And so right now we are in a great state of flux and conflict. And so there are different parts of the world where their work is needed and wanted. And to some degree, there are many countries where they simply don't want any help on any basis.
Do you believe that beyond the alien bases on the moon, do you believe there are alien bases here?
I would say that that would be a rather firm possibility.
Okay, let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
I wanted to know if your guest has read Our Mysterious Spaceship Moon by Don Wilson.
No, I haven't.
It's a theory about the moon is hollow.
Mm-hmm.
And that one of the reasons he thinks that is because the huge craters are convex, the same curvature in the middle, so that in other words, it'd be like if you hit a ball, and a hollow ball, it would push in and then spring back out.
Mm-hmm.
And the craters should be, concave, but
yeah,
they aren't. They're convex.
And didn't the Russians conduct some kind of sound sonar experiment?
Yeah.
And get some kind of...
Yeah, this, is, that's, this yeah. is the same book that it crescendos.
It?
When you hit it, it crescendos, and only a hollow sphere crescendos.
Well, in actuality, from what I understand, the Earth does the same thing. And every time an atomic bomb is released, it also crescendos and it also rings. And we know that the Earth has a molten core. So I can't really say one way or the other whether it is hollow or it is not. I can only speculate at the fact that it does produce a magnetic field. And we know through geophysics that to produce a magnetic field and consequent gravitational forces and so on and so forth, there has to be some type of inner geological activity. How much that is or how little that is, I'm not privy to that information.
Okay, it'd have to be pretty big. It's pretty big to be artificial, don't you think?
I would say that it's a very, very large body, one would have to wonder, if the rock core samplings and everything indicate, and the element samplings indicate that it's approximately as old as the Earth itself, there are still many theories that it came from the planet, that the Earth ejected it, or that it was captured, or what have you. But it does have a very geophysical construction and mass to it.
If this, Glenn, is a black ops program, then disclosure may never come.
I would not, and I think this is a very relevant point. I don't feel that anyone legitimately can expect our officials or someone, once again, who everyone wants to see is reputable, to stand up in front of them and say, well, listen, ladies and gentlemen, we have been pulling your leg for a while, or we have been keeping information from you, and so on and so forth, but now we're going to come clean. I think that Dr. Friedman, who I saw on your website and I've met numerous times, is quite correct with his assumption that this entire subject, or the collection of UFO data, was given greater classification than the Manhattan Project, and continues to hold that classification to this day. And that no one will stand up and admit that that over a progressive period of time that everyone involved with this, and we still have members that are alive today, that were partaking of this particular project to keep information away from the public. But one has to understand, we empower them to do that. We tell the officials we elect, and we ask of the military forces to defend us and keep us safe, and we tell our officials, you stand in front of us and tell me that everything's going to be okay, and you're going to take responsibility for everything and make it better, and we say, hallelujah, go ahead and do it. So we empower them, and if they feel that they need to keep certain things from us, then we have told them to do so.
Do you agree with that?
I necessarily don't. No, obviously I would not be doing what I'm doing today or for the last 40 years. But
So you agree with disclosure?
I agree that it should be made public, absolutely. I just feel that to expect them to do that would be, really wishing in the wind.
What has the private reaction been to your father's book and your update? not by the American public or the public at large, but by those in the know?
I have received absolutely no negative input, none whatsoever. Some people are a bit, some organizations or some individuals are a bit, let's say, not willing to support George Adamski for a variety of reasons. But then again, neither were they present for those experiences as well, and one can only stand upon one's 2 feet for what one has experienced themselves. And so the reality of the matter is that is where we got our jump and where we had all the experiences that were built upon and culminated through the many decades thereafter.
Do you believe, Glenn, do you believe beyond a shadow of a doubt that what is happening on the moon right now, according to your thoughts, are for our benefit or our danger?
Benefit. In one form or another, it's in our benefit. If it's operations that is conducted by our own operation facilities up there, then they are trying to use the materials and conduct experimentation that hopefully eventually will trickle down, if that theory even still exists, into the coffers of our own benefit. And if it is from the other side, then they have no reason to be aggressive. If anything, they have experienced aggression. We have shot at them, fired at them, shot lasers and everything else we could possibly think of, and they have not acted aggressively in any manner. So I think that if anything, it allows us in a close proximity, unless you have very good telescopic equipment, and we're talking, you know, 18-inch reflectors,
sure,
or huge refractors and what have you, or much larger, you really don't have a great deal of opportunity to look at anything. Even if you look at Mars, what do you see? It's the size of a quarter if you're lucky. And so on and so forth. So the moon allows us something that we can see by the eye, which we can attract our thoughts to, and then we can even use our own instrumentation to look closer. And there are always a network of people with telescopes who will see something and call the next one in four or five states over to make sure that you don't get angular reflections and things like that.
All right, we'll be back with more and phone calls in a moment. Glenn, if and when the Chinese get to the moon, do you think they'll disclose what they see?
Well, I definitely think that there are other political bodies and countries on this planet that are more open to this information. Like I mentioned to you before, from my contacts in the Ukraine and the former Soviet Union, they told me directly. We were discussing the aggressive pursuing of these UFOs and the fact that we had shot at them and what have you. And he wrote back and told me that there had been a system-wide command given out to the Soviet forces already a long time ago, 20 years ago, that they would not pursue or shoot at these vehicles, and one of the political people and several high-ranking officers who disobeyed the rule were court-martialed because of it. And I have noticed that they are much more open to the information and the reporting of that information, which was in fact one of the emphases of the meeting with those scientists in 1989. So I believe when the Chinese get there, I think they're going there for a very definite reason. The Japanese every year put a $10 million aside for research into construction of lunar facilities, which they wouldn't be spending the money if they didn't plan to go there either. So I think that a number of countries will be interested to go there and get the information from themselves, because up to a certain point, there has been only one clearinghouse for space information, and I think they're looking for a little bit more.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. You are on the air. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going? My name's Jake, and I'm calling from Eugene, Oregon. Hi. Great show, you guys. Great show. Just wanted to ask you a few questions, Glenn, if I could. First question is, now, you said that these structures that you're talking about, they are visible with a fairly decent telescope, or does it require some kind of filter to see more definition?
Well, Jake, there's several methods of magnification to use when you use a telescope. You know that the higher the magnification of the lens, let's say you go from a 20-millimeter lens, which gives you a lot of light and a lot of viewability, to a 9 or 7-millimeter lens, which is highly magnified, but it lets in a lot less light, so actually makes it harder to view under those conditions. And, of course, you have the atmospheric disturbance between the Earth and the Moon and everything else involved, so sometimes you get distortions. But if you use a lens like a Barlow lens, where you can use a high wider magnification lens and then double its power, you still are incorporating the same amount of light being let in. So yes, indeed, to answer the question, there is a possibility of using ground-based telescopes, and a large number of individuals do that and train themselves on certain areas of the Moon. There was the Alpine Valley that so many astronomers, amateur astronomers, reported lights moving along the ridges, along the valleys, along the surface from many different angles, many different times. So yes, that is visible with your own equipment.
Now, my next question is, thank you for asking or answering that one, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But my next question is, now, are these structures that have been talked about, not necessarily the ones that have actually been seen by people on Earth, are some of these on the dark side of the Moon? Do we even know what's on the dark side of the Moon?
Well, the dark side of the Moon, of course, is not susceptible to the intense gravitational pull of the Earth. And so the backside of the Moon has a much more stable environment as far as maintaining surface pressure, and there is some talk that, like in Death Valley, the deeper you go, the denser the atmospheric concentration. The same would be in a crater. If you went down 2,000 or 3,000 feet in the crater, you would have greater density or accumulation based upon that depth as well below sea level. So the backside of the Moon, a large number of photographs were taken of Tycho and Archimedes and many other areas on the backside that have shown even greater activity. And there has been some speculation that since we were aiming rockets and lasers and things at the Moon, that some of these constructions were actually moved to the backside. And Kassendi Crater was one of those, namely that area. Greater Kassendi, with the 1930s shot from the Mount Wilson Observatory, showed a huge array of tubular constructions along the bottom of the crater leading through the outside of the crater and continuing on the other side. Taking pictures of it 20, 30, 40 years later, you see these starting to decline and actually some of them disappearing. And so there's speculation that for their own safety sakes, whoever has these particular constructions find the backside of the Moon to be more environmentally friendly in many aspects.
Do you believe that the shadow government, what some people also call the Illuminati, Glenn, might be behind what's going on there now?
Well, as to, you know, particular organizations, there have been many different labelings of who this may be, and consortiums of different power structures and what have you. I would say that there are decisions made on many different levels. We look at our elected officials, whether it happens to be in the House or Congress or sitting in the White House or what have you, and we see this as the ultimate apex of decision making. But there are areas, since the governments are inherently bureaucratic, each one defends and defines their own structure as much as possible. And of course, you find arguments between the two. But you have men of power, men and women of power, that are belonging to organizations that make decisions that are more of global consequence versus than what we consider to be the petty public aggravation of what we see today in the newspapers.
Let's go first-time caller line. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
How are you this evening?
We are fine. Thanks.
This morning, should I say. My question, Glenn, do you think that there's a possibility that the moon, let's say about a million years or so ago, could have been very much like the Earth, and that something happened like a thermal cooling of the core that could have caused the moon to die?
Well, that depends here. We're talking in the realm of the theories at this particular moment, and you know, there's still open questions on whether the moon was ejected from the Earth at a certain point or whether it was captured at a certain point. And that, still having this source unknown, we would be very difficult to formulate an answer to that question. It would be difficult to say, since it's been in the gravitational influence of the Earth, then it doesn't have complete rotation, and so we're talking about the forces with the core of rotation and gravitational security and things like that. So the geophysics are different with a lunar body versus a planetary body. So I would have to say that at this point, the best we could hope for is to look at the theories and hope that the data we get will give us an answer at least to the beginnings of this particular period, and then we can build from there.
Yeah. But just kind of hypothetically speaking, if a planet was that had a core, you know, very much like the Earth, if that core was to cool rapidly, mm-hmm. you know, making major changes, I mean, would that cause a planet to physically die?
Absolutely. In fact, if anyone watched the NOVA program this evening talking about a magnetic storm was the name of the program,
mm-hmm.
it was very fascinating. It talks about the geophysical alterations of the of our particular planet, the shifting of the poles every 100,000 years or so, and the fact that it is a very measurable slowing down of the magnetic sphere of influence and cooling of the core, which leads to the alterations in the planet. And we know logically over a period of time nothing lasts forever, and there is a cycle of building as well as there is a cycle of destruction, which is really not destruction because the molecules will be re-energized and formed again, but we won't be here to see it.
Have you seen the movie The Core?
No, great
movie, mm-hmm. about the fact that the core stops moving and they have to go down there and try to fix it and they mm-hmm. get it jump started again. But it's interesting theories.
Well, there are some things that are not theory. There are scientific bodies who have measured that every time we explode an atomic device, not only do we get the resonance, as that one lady mentioned about that ringing sound, which actually Dr. Wilbert Smith talked about, the project director of Project Magnet at one point, but also there is a measurable slowing down of the planet's revolution. Now, it doesn't take rocket scientists to realize here that the balance between the spinning of the core in opposition to the rotation of the planet creates the environment of balance upon which we live. When we start with our ludicrousy to fool with those geophysics alongside of what the planet already does on itself, on its natural cycle, we're talking about accelerating certain consequences that we have no reason to want to participate in. We are very strange, and I use the analogy that we're all in a life raft, and somebody takes a penknife and starts punching the sides to see how quickly it is before this thing sinks. And, you know, in shark-infested waters, there's not a lot of logic being done here because we live on a finite source. We have not built 50-mile spacecrafts like have been observed on the moon, stretching from one end of the crater to the next, to transport our people somewhere else. I would think that we would have greater understanding and tolerance towards the protection of our planet, and that doesn't mean that we can't have economic progress, but we have to change the emphasis of that. And I think some of this information is exactly why these extraterrestrials have come here.
All right, let's go next to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, again, again. Okay, Glenn, what is your last name again? Because I'm calling you from Chicago, and at 3 o'clock, they cut you off. So I'm
Stecklin, Stecklin, S-T-E-C-K-L-I-N-G is his last name.
Okay, so I can pick you up on the webpage then. Okay, in 1959, I had the pleasure of spending some 7 hours with Mr. George Adamski. I thought I was unique until I heard what your father has gone through, so consequently, I see I'm not so unique. But it changed my life forever. I met two men there who read my mind, who predicted the future by 20 minutes and had strange-looking chronometers, which I called a wristwatch. And then I saw three UFOs from apart, no more than 1,000 feet away, while suspended in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So I know what you're saying, and he was quite a gentleman.
Oh, he was
my
very
questions
unique.
To... Pardon?
He was very unique. No
yes,
one else
he was,
like
and very modest, and I was quite surprised, because he didn't even know me, and he spent that much time with me after one of his lectures. Now, my questions to you are these. I read the book some time ago, Mysterious Spaceship Moon. And it talked about the Hadley Riles, this 8-mile-long area of water that's released again into no air and from no source, that most of the craters there, no matter how large the impact areas, go down no more than 3.5 miles. And I heard you mention, too, the crater Tycho, which has many radiant lights, also the Mare Crisium and the bridge in Aristarchus.
Right.
So I really would like to talk with you again. I have some pictures, too, that were blown up that he gave me at that time, showing the cigar... this long cigar-shaped spaceship or mothership, and this Venusian bell-shaped craft. It's very beautiful pictures. So I would like to be able
those,
to reach
well,
you
a large
again.
Number of those are in the book as well, yes.
Oh, you do?
Yeah,
well,
because
I
we own
that
the copyrights
book.
To all of George Adamski's films and pictures and everything.
Okay, well, just go to his website, and there's a way for people to email you, Glenn?
Yes, it's directly on the website. They're more than welcome to email me. I'm often on the road, so I like to take care of the email personally as much as possible, so sometimes there's a little lag in time before I can get to everyone personally, but I definitely make that attempt.
Very good. Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yes, it is.
This is Justin, formerly from New Orleans, now calling from Greensboro, North Carolina.
You've moved.
Yes, sir, to get closer to God and better radio reception. And wouldn't you know, I'm in a cinder block apartment, so a Justice AM antenna is in order.
Well, good to have you with us. Go ahead.
It's good to be here. I have two questions. Oh, hello, Glenn, by the way.
Hello, Justin.
I have two questions for you both. Would not have space visitors on the moon interfered with the Apollo missions for fear of discovery? And would not their purpose to be prevention of human self-destruction rather than invasion?
I would say the first question, they were there, and as correlated by some of the astronauts as well as Maurice Chatelain, they were already there, and they were already accompanying a lot of the crafts there as a purpose of helping along should that help be required. So. They were not there for any interference at all of anything. They were telling the guys, hey, guess what? As far as the prevention of destruction, I would say that we definitely have walked that avenue several times. And I would think that over a period of time that, yes, there has been constructive reasoning and a different points of perception and realism injected periodically in particular times in history. And I believe, without a doubt, as Professor Oppenheimer said after his retirement, when they asked him, we cannot take advantage of all the scientific evolvement over the last 50 years. And when they asked him, well, who helped us, he just pointed to the sky and said, those guys up there. Afterwards, he became a crackpot. So, you know, but he was in good company along with Einstein and everybody else.
Geniuses are.
Right. So prevention, I think, to some degree... we have to learn to be responsible for what we do, because there is cause and effect, and what we put in motion will have, returning motion as well.
Well, I cite the examples of the Russian silo incident for the second one about the prevention of self-destruction, as well as the Mars interferences we've had with our probes. Now, you're suggesting that the astronauts had prior knowledge of the existence of these visitors on the moon?
I don't say that they were priorly briefed. I believe some of them already from the X-15 project. That was reported in the newspaper that already through the X-Series project and the high atmosphere that they photographed numerous of these objects flying in formation. So to some degree, already from the time of the early 1940s, this was knowledge. Whether these particular commissioned officers were sat down and said, hey, you know, you might come across this, I personally think that they left them to understand that and then to take care of that in the debriefing.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I got one real quick connection. I'm reading Jules Verne's Mysterious Island, and one of the characters believes the moon is a frozen star who lost its internal fires and believes the Earth's going to happen that same way in a few million years. And I thought that was an interesting correlation y'all were talking about just a minute. But I want to say thank you, George. Thank
you,
everybody, Coast to Coast, and y'all have a great night.
You
thank
too.
You.
And that is a very interesting theory. By the way, those of you who might live in the Arlington, Texas area, if you want to fast blast me, because someone is just all over fast blast right now, saying that right now that he sees a huge triangular-shaped craft. So if anybody's out there in that area, run out there, take a peek, and come back and fast blast me. There's a lot of things going on in the heavens, Glenn.
Well, yes, this evening is the meteor shower as well. And of course, over a period of years, I believe our research and development and projects have also developed our own type of crafts that are based initially on nuclear fusion propulsion and more into electromagnetics. And from the reports that I receive and information that I'm privy to, that these days as much as 50% of the sightings can be of earthly design.
Well, that's a pretty good percent. We'll be back with you and more. Glenn Steckling, my guest. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Reserve your free CD of Art Bell and Malachi Martin when you subscribe to After Dark. Call toll-free 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505.
There's music in the air, lots of love and everywhere. So give me the night. Give me the night.
Lex did a little research for me. Space.com had a story a day or so ago about the moon seen as an astronomical outpost eventually, and that you could just do incredible things with devices on the moon. As a matter of fact, there was a scientist who is recommending that we put huge solar panels on the moon, and then we are able to beam via laser the energy back to our receivers here on the planet, and we'd have free solar energy. The sun is always there, isn't it? Free solar energy, and just send it right back to us, and we'd put it right into the grid. That could be very amazing. Lots of things you could use the moon for, Glenn, huh?
Absolutely, and I also feel that electromagnetic energy, the dynamo of the planet itself, producing hundreds of trillions and billions of watts of energy, can be tapped into very much as Nikola Tesla and others have discovered and divulged over a period of time.
Indeed. West of the Rockies, welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Glenn.
Uh-huh.
My question is, did Mr. Adamski, did your dad, or do you have any information about the Grays?
Well, let's say that there is a very definitive line between what was reported up till, let's say, 1961, probably the earliest, but more so late in the late 60s, and what has continued on from that time forward. Historically, the interactions between extraterrestrial visitors has been reported to be with humanoids, where there is no fear or abductions or any type of a negative contact. Let's face it, if you're going to try to get scientific data, you don't terrify it first in order to get reliable readings. So there's this period of history that goes back thousands of years up to the early 60s that did not specifically have any of these type of reports. And since that time, these type of things have accelerated. I personally believe there's a reasons for that, but I have not had, nor have never been associated, either George or my father, or anyone who associates with us that had any experiences with these type of reported individuals.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, you are very welcome for that. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You are on Coast to Coast. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
How you doing, George?
We are well.
Doing,
good evening.
My name is David from Sacramento. I just wanted to ask the question. Before the moon came into existence, do you know or do you have any information on what the Earth used as a satellite, such as Mars? Because according to the information that I have, Mars used to be our satellite for Earth.
Well, from what I understand, according to planetary or solar systemic construction, and also from information that was given to George Adamski, that the planets are formed around the sun in a balanced method, of which usually a number of 12 is congruent, 12 planets and a sun. And we have, of course, talked about 9, but there are 3 other discoveries that are beyond the furthest planet of Pluto, X, Y, and Z, as they have been designated.
Right.
The Soviets have reported them in the 70s, and we have talked to them about as well, and this, of course, is another issue, talking about the number of planets in our system. The information that I am aware of is that the planets are in a balanced orbit very much like a well-defined clock. And if you extract or destruct a planet from its synchronized orbit, you will set up a chain reaction which starts to cause the degradation of the rest of the planets in the solar system and also affect the balance of the sun. So there has been talk about planets wandering through a solar system, but according to the magnetic influences and how a solar system and planets stay in orbit, I have not seen any information to support that theory. I feel that everything works very finely within the balance of nature and the principles of nature and creation for a specific reason.
Right.
Nothing is haphazard.
Okay, the other thing I wanted to say is make a comment on is in the early 70s or late 70s, I met Captain Ed Mitchell, sit down and talk with them in a seminar called The Mind Can Do Anything.
Mm-hmm.
Good man, by the way, isn't he?
Pardon me?
He's a good man, isn't
he? Oh, yeah, he is a very humble person, and I believe to be a very, very honest and truthful person. But what I wanted to say is that a comment that he made when he had went to the moon, he said that, according to a document, that there were ships up there when they went, and they gave them warning, and they told them to leave, and they got in their capsule and took off. Now, I wanted to know.
That's news to me.
this is what, and it's documented. So I wanted to see if George or you had some information on that as well as a mothercraft or whatever type of ship that he reported that was up there.
Well, my feeling is that it is considered that a planet and its satellites are part of that planetary body. We would not be prevented of going to our own satellite because it falls within the realm and sphere of our planet and our right to explore and to conduct the experiments necessary to eventually go out into deeper space. So I have not heard anything that that says that we would not be allowed to go there. I would say that should we take our aggressive tendencies to some other world, then naturally they have the right to prevent that from infiltrating their system.
Excellent. Thanks for that phone call. Let's go up next to our first-time caller line. You are on Coast to Coast with Glenn Stecklin. Hi there.
Hi, George. How you doing? I'm your age. I remember that, you know, incident for the Edmund Fitzgerald, you know, just like you described.
Yes, absolutely.
It was terrible. What I wanted to say was I've been a listener since 96, Art Bell.
Mm-hmm.
When I was out in Las Vegas on vacation, I picked him up. I've been listening ever since.
Hooked,
terrific,
huh?
Show.
Thanks.
And you are a terrific replacement.
Thank you.
What I wanted to say was I kind of follow up on what the other caller said, kind of stole my thunder. I looked at this sci-fi show several years ago, and an astronaut by the name of Eugene Cernan, I don't know if you ever remember.
Of course.
Oh, yes.
You know, he was an astronaut in the program, and he came on, and he said the reason we didn't go back to the moon since 69 was because when they were up there, they saw, you know, alien crafts which were kind of threatening them in a menacing sort of way, not doing anything, but just kind of hovering. In other words, you know, get out of here and don't come back. that kind of stuff.
Well, did he say that, or was it reported that he said that?
He said it. I actually heard him say it.
Okay.
But he said he wasn't allowed to make it public because, they didn't want everybody to get all excited and, upset.
Yeah.
So they kept it quiet. But I did hear him say that.
That's a incredible story.
This was on the Sci-Fi Channel several years ago. They haven't repeated it since. It may have been 2 or 3 years ago.
Glenn, aware of that?
Well, I'm aware of course, astronaut Crennan, and I believe he was Apollo. He was the last Apollo mission.
And also, Glenn, he said that other astronauts know the same thing, and they're shutting up. But he didn't want to name them.
Well, yeah, we remember we went to the moon after 1969 because we had programs all the way till Apollo 17.
Right.
Now, my question would be, what is considered to be a perception of menacing? I mean, if you, let's put it bluntly, if you walk outside now,
right,
and a 20-mile-long spacecraft is hovering above your town, is that menacing to you, but not necessarily menacing as far as their activity? Because if we cannot control our own fears and uncertainties, then we consider the presence of something to be menacing.
Well, let me put it this way. I would still go outside and live my life after seeing that. Yeah. I mean,
By the way, this is one of the things that Cernan said in 1973 in the Los Angeles Times. Says, I've been asked about UFOs, and I've said publicly I thought they were somebody else, some other civilization. That's pretty remarkable stuff.
Well,
And here's also a quote from Brian O'Leary. Contacts between extraterrestrials seem to have been going on for decades, and we still don't want to admit it.
Uh-huh.
And also Gordon Cooper, in a very early interview in 1970, said intelligent beings from other planets regularly visit our world in an effort to enter into contact with us. I've encountered various ships during my space voyages. NASA and the American government know this and possess a great deal of evidence. Nevertheless, they remain silent in order to not alarm the people. And then they ask them what they look like, and they said they look just like you and I, no different.
Wow. That I didn't hear.
Not at all.
That
was on
Merv Griffin.
Okay, appreciate it. By the way, still getting lots of fast blasts now from Oklahoma, Glenn, that they've seen some large triangular-shaped object. And Robert out there in Arlington, Texas, is going crazy here. He says, look, I've been a combat veteran and everything else, and he said this thing went right over my house. Robert, I believe you.
Mm-hmm.
I believe you, but somebody get a picture of this thing.
I recently received a document, and I have not been able to authenticate the validity of it, but it talks about the research and development by us of a craft called a TR-3B, which is a triangular craft. And it says that it is much more sophisticated than the Aurora program, and it is also some of the sightings that were made or being perpetrated as some of the sightings that were made over Phoenix and Belgium those years when they were reporting several of these triangular craft in formation hovering. So that's another piece to the puzzle.
Clock ticks, Glenn. The book, we got a few more minutes, but we'll take a few more calls. But tell us a little bit more, Alien Bases on the Moon 2, where can one get it?
You can get it directly from us. As I mentioned before, you can find that address on the website so we don't burn too much time here. Or you can order it directly from Borders or Baker & Taylor, Amazon.com.
They all have it. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, it's exciting. I got through and I'll make it quick.
Sure.
A guy at NASA who I met through nothing related to NASA was just sharing different things to me and, about spacecrafts and what have you. And he said back in, and this was 1986, that I was sent on assignment and met this guy. So it was before 1986, just to give you a point of reference,
mm-hmm.
that when the tiles fell off the shuttle, and he said during a press conference, one of the press reporters asked, how do you know what number the tile is? And they said, well, we took a picture of it. And he said the NASA guy should not have said that, but it just kind of went over everybody's head and they didn't pay attention. I was telling this story to a guy who was a former fighter pilot, and as soon as I said that, he said, well, I guess they knew that they were going to burn up. Meaning that if we could take pictures of the little number on the tiles back pre-1986, that this shuttle that burnt up, they obviously had pictures and knew how bad it was.
Well, that's a possibility. I personally feel that, according to the launch protocols, that there's a requirement for systems checks, and I cannot imagine that we would send a commander, a mission commander, for I know that pilots would not accept the same thing, without being able to do an external inspection of their craft. We sent them up there with no ability to go into space. We didn't give them the backpack. Basically, we sent them up there with absolutely no other options, not enough fuel to make the space station and what have you. And the discussion of what damage may have occurred already started after the post-launch sequence. And unfortunately, this device is 25 years old. I mean, let's face it, ladies and gentlemen, you wouldn't want to get into a 25, 30-year-old airliner. You know, it's time to upgrade things, and that means we have to spend money and we have to dedicate technology, because the research and development of things associated with the space program you are using every day in your home, and many people don't even know it. You would transistors, computers, microwaves, all the technology has gone into that, has trickled down.
Are you aware, by the way, Ingo Swann wrote a book, and of course he was the father of remote viewing, mm-hmm. Alien bases on the moon also. So, I mean, you do have some support out there.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, once one is actively engaged and gets to see and have access to many different things, you know, support is a nice thing to have, but you have to have your own motivation and inner support to carry on the work if you wish to.
Prior to saying good night, Glenn, what would you like to say to the millions?
Well, I think that it's important that we look at this. No one has all the answers, for nobody could reasonably be expected to stand in front of you and make such a claim and say, here's the truth and the total truth, because facts and discoveries and the revelations from such evolve with every microsecond. So we should remember we are empowered to think, to ask questions, to expect rational answers. This is one of the blessings of our democracy, but it's of no value unless we participate in it. And in this field in particular, we need to look deeply. We need to search for historical foundation. This gives us a sense of direction. It identifies sudden or changes or questions that may come to mind. But more importantly, we need to ask how life, nature, and creation functions on this planet around us, and why we would expect it to be so totally different, that the intelligence that controls all of this around us would be so totally different as to fancify our imaginations if we left this tiny planet. And I think if we maintain that foundation, we'll get answers that make sense.
Well said. Thanks, Glenn. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Barbara Simpson, who, by the way, will do next, right after Thanksgiving, next Friday and Saturday night's program, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next program. Until then, be safe.